the perhaps 15th, 16th installment of these conversations that I have been hosting for Sapir ever since we began the journal a little over a year ago. And we've tried to feature writers from across the ideological spectrum and writers on a whole range of subjects. And Ruel, yours in appearing in our fourth issue, Aspiration, which I'm holding a copy of right here, on the question of what it will take to bring down the Islamic regime, the Islamic Republic of Iran by 2030, I think has garnered a great deal of attention. And it's even with what's happening in Ukraine, and I think we'll want to talk about that, even with what's happening in Ukraine, or perhaps especially because of what's happening in Ukraine, I think could hardly be more, more topical than it is now. I'll just say a couple of words, prefatory words, before we get into the conversation. Ruel and I will chat for about 40 minutes or so. This is an hour-long conversation. And at around the 40-minute mark, I will start reading questions that you can put in either the chat or the Q&A function. So as questions occur to those of you in our audience, put them in the chat function. And I think there's even a way of removing your question if you have second thoughts about it. But the intention here is really to broaden the conversation beyond the two of us. Ruel, let me begin with the state of play in Vienna. News has sort of trickled out, hints and whispers of a deal that is not, as Tony Blinken promised us, longer and stronger. But we don't know for sure. So what are you hearing about what we can expect and when?
Well, I mean, if the past is a gauge, the Iranian press has been giving better reporting on it than the than the American press. And if they're accurate and even partially accurate, it's going to be a phase deal. And the Iranians seem to be quite happy about it. There does seem to be a bit of a hiccup that may not have been planned because the IAEA director, Rafael Grossi, did go to Tehran and he did remind them that they had not answered his questions about manipulated uranium particles that had been discovered primarily because of the Israeli intelligence that came through the archive heist. And so he expects some answer to that. Now, if the past is again a guide, that's not going to stop the deal. It's not going to derail it, but it may cause a somewhat longer entry period. We don't know. I mean, the rumors were that you were going to actually have maybe a deal announced as quickly as this week. I'm not sure that's still on the table, but it does appear that the deal is going to happen and they will receive substantial sanctions and relief. It does appear that the Russians will take custody of that uranium. They're highly enriched uranium, the 60% uranium. It's not clear what's going to be the top threshold of uranium enrichment that the Biden administration will allow. You see Iranian reports saying that they have allowed 20%. I don't know if that's accurate. I find all those discussions fairly irrelevant since we know for sure they're not going to seriously curtail the development of advanced centrifuges. We know for a fact that they have a very large stockpile of centrifuge parts and miraging steel, which is required for the production of centrifuges. So, and we saw already when they decided to amp up their program after Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the JCPOA, they can put online these machines pretty bloody quickly and they can ramp up the enrichment percentage purity to basically whatever the level they want rapidly.
Right, so, and I think one point that's worth just explaining, a technical point, is that the difficulty of getting uranium to a state where you can use it in a civilian nuclear plant is considerable. But then with each successive jump from 5% to 20% to 60% to 90%, becomes that much easier. It's like trying to use a blender to liquefy fruit. The process accelerates.
Exactly. I mean, the hardest part is getting up to 20%. They've already mastered that. And they've made faster progress with the development of the centrifuges than their primary overlord and expert, Ali Salehi, who has a PhD from nuclear engineering from MIT. He had written extensively on this. He was a big advocate of the JCPOA. And his argument was the JCPOA's sunset clauses overlapped with the time required to develop the advanced centrifuges. So the Iranians lose nothing by that deal, and they gain all the money and the access to greater commerce and trade. They've actually made faster progress in developing the IR-4s and the 6s than I think he anticipated. So they're in a very good state.
So let me ask you this. We are about to, if this deal goes through and if Russia is a major player in becoming the custodian of the more highly enriched uranium, the uranium that's at 60%, we're not talking huge quantities, right, but if Russia in a sense is a linchpin player in this agreement, are we not hostaging an agreement to a country we are otherwise doing everything short of war to oppose in terms of Ukraine? I mean, this does not seem to me a linkage which favors American interests.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd use hostaging, but it is certainly amusing that the Russians, who were trying to isolate every place else, or have, you know, inserted themselves to be at least a player in this agreement. And you could certainly tell by looking at Ambassador Ulyanov that they were enjoying it considerably. And you also have to think that Putin and the ambassador was probably well aware of the invasion. So they've been more or less stage managing this, anticipating what would happen after the invasion of Ukraine. So I have to give the Russian ambassador bonus points. I think he's played a very weak hand in Vienna well.
So take off for a moment your Middle East analyst hat and put on your Washington Politico hat.
Yeah.
My sense is that a deal with Iran that is not longer and stronger, and that gives Russia added diplomatic leverage, is not going to play very well politically for the Biden administration at this particular moment in time. In fact, it seems to me politically disastrous from just the raw, you know, interests of the administration and not being seen yet again as weak and collapsing to an aggressive foreign power. How do you think this plays out in Congress?
Well, I mean, I think this is certainly going to be more distasteful politically than the JCPOA was. Yes. Now, the Iran issue has become a polarized political issue. So most Democrats are going to be in favor of this deal. Most Republicans and a few notable Democrats will be opposed. I think there'll be a larger number of Democrats up on the Hill who privately will express their dismay. But I do expect the Biden administration to draw from the Obama playbook, and that is, they're going to say, what's your alternative? It's either this deal or war or surrender. And the Republicans are going to come back and essentially, it's sort of frozen in amber. They're going to say, well, no, you're going to increase sanctions and we're going to wait for a better deal. But the nuclear facts on the ground tell you that Iran has essentially become a nuclear weapons capable state. The only thing that might be stopping them is if you believe the Israeli estimate, I describe it as a guess, that they're 18 to 24 months away from building a nuclear trigger. You know, that's the only thing that's keeping them from being a nuclear weapons state. We know from the archives and from our own intelligence that, you know, they've more or less mastered everything else.
So, So let's relitigate for a second the wisdom of Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA back in 2018, because the criticism obviously is we had a deal that for all of its many, many flaws, Iran was not flagrantly cheating on. It was cheating on it. We know that, but it was at least keeping Iran's bid to enrich uranium to higher levels of purity in check. It was more or less functioning. Trump comes along, imposes the most punitive sanctions possible, and all it did, according to the critics, is incentivize Iran to sprint rather than stop.
Well, I mean, I think you have to start with, are you in favor of a virulently anti-American theocracy extorting the United States? I mean, that's essentially what the JCPOA was. Now, if you're comfortable with that, then I think you can make an argument that, you know, maybe we get 10 years out of the JCPOA. Trump accelerated history. There's no doubt about that. He also stopped the extortion. I would argue you really only had two plausible options. You could either go for preventive military strikes with all the unknowns involved in that to see if you could disrupt, convulse the nuclear program, or you say, all right, defend the nuke, but we're going to adopt a Cold War strategy. We're going to maintain sanctions, and we're going to have, to whatever extent we can, politically acceptable, have some type of containment strategy. Everything else, I think you lose. With the JCPOA, you were giving a regime that has engaged in despicable behavior, who has gained dominance in the northern Middle East, and you're giving them money, you're fueling them, you're allowing them to expand, you're stopping certainly the economic factors that became evident in the uprisings, the demonstrations in 2017 and 2019, you're stopping that economic factor, which led to a considerable tumult inside of the country. And I think that's what we want to see. We want to see greater tumult. American sanctions were not the primary agent behind those internal convulsions, but they certainly were a factor. The Biden administration will do its best to eliminate that factor. So, I think that's it. I mean, I think appeasement's a plausible policy if you're Liechtenstein. I think appeasement's a pretty bad policy if you're a superpower. But unfortunately, that is not the way the United States has conducted itself vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic. Over the years since 1979, they have killed and wounded hundreds of Americans in each and every time, minus the 1988, where the U.S. Navy destroyed the Iranian Navy, and Donald Trump's surprise action of taking out Qasem Soleimani, and every time, and we've ignored their lethal actions.
So let's talk about the Israeli angle of this angle here. I mean, Israel has since Olmert, if not before, maybe the Sharon government, been warning very starkly that under no circumstances would it allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon, but they also talked at least privately about a nuclear weapon capability. And just to make that clear to everyone tuning in, you know, Japan is a nuclear weapons capable state in that it has the wherewithal to rapidly assemble a robust nuclear arsenal in a matter of probably weeks, because it has plutonium, uranium, the technological know-how. It chooses not to. And Israel has spoken, Israeli leaders have spoken emphatically that not only do they not want Iran with a nuclear weapon per se, they don't want it to have the capability of having a nuclear weapon, the infrastructure. Now, what you're telling me is that in effect, Iran has achieved that or is very close to achieving that. And at least in the last year, we've seen no evidence of robust Israeli activity. It's been at least a year since something blew up in Isfahan or Natanz or one of those places. Do you sense that Israel is just reaching kind of the same conclusion that the Biden administration has reached, that a nuclear Iran or a nuclear capable Iran is something they're just going to learn to live with?
I think that's probably the reality. I mean, I think the there was a moment a little over 10 years ago where Netanyahu really did want to preempt. He wanted to go for it. But, you know, he was, as I understand it, voted down in the cabinet. And prime ministers do not have plenipotentiary authority. They have to seek cabinet approval for a military strike like that. So he was unable to do so. And certainly there have been many instances where the Israelis should have hit, as they did in 2007 in Syria, when the program was in its infancy in Syria, when the Iranians transferred technology to the Assad regime and started building a nuclear facility near Deir ez-Zor. I think one has to say there's less volition, less unanimity on the Iran issue in Israel than there was under Netanyahu, actually. So I'm deeply skeptical that the Israelis are going to act. I think they are essentially accepting, you know, MAD is a doctrine, mutually assured destruction.
So one of your contention in your Sapir essay is that the Islamic Republic, for all of its many, many self-inflicted wounds, has proved to be a remarkably resilient enterprise. They have resisted enormous pressure, economic pressure, never mind domestic political pressure. The regime might be hated by most of its people, but of course it's quite obviously not a democracy, and all you need are 100,000 willful people with guns to keep a regime like that in power, and they can stay in power long beyond what economic logic would dictate. Kim Jong-un in North Korea proves that every single day he remains in power. And your thesis is that the only thing that could conceivably bring down the regime would be a successful Israeli military strike that has a way of loosening things so that something could combust, something could come apart within the regime in a way that can't be stopped. What you seem to now be telling me is you've given up hope even of that.
Well, I mean, I think that's probably true. I mean, I still believe the regime is fragile internally, and they know it. And, you know, authoritarian regimes become fragile when they can no longer track accurately the ebb and flow of their own society, when they don't see the breaking points. And the regime has trouble doing that, but even there, you have to give them credit. I mean, we know because the Islamic Republic is fairly leaky. We can, if you pay attention, get a lot of information about internal deliberations in the Islamic Republic, particularly in the Revolutionary Guard Corps. So we are aware, one, that they are aware that they are ruling over a disgruntled, to put it politely, populace. So they adjust their tactics. And the most disconcerting thing is that, for example, after the massive pro-democracy Green Movement demonstrations, which brought millions of people out on the streets of Tehran in 2009, they had meetings in August of that year of the Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders where they dissected what happened. And they came up with several conclusions. And if you read those meetings, and we've been able to get a hold of video of them, you can see that they are working their way through the various problems. And most importantly, they decide that the key element is you have to strike early and strike savagely. And if you then look forward up to 2017, 2019, you see it. They actually engaged in more brutality quicker. And it worked. I mean, they virtually had an insurrection in some of the minority provinces in 2019. It was getting very violent. So, you know, they brought out folks and they started machine gunning people. And regrettably, that works. I mean, the only way you have regime change in authoritarian state is if the security services crack. And one day that might happen, but all we can say for certain is in 2019, they didn't crack. And not only didn't they crack, you saw later almost no remorse in the higher reaches of the government. You did see considerable remorse in 2009, I think because for the very first time, they really used rape in a systematic way. And I think even some people inside of the regime are shocked by that behavior.
You talked earlier about the Israelis accepting mutually assured destruction as the next stage of deterrence against Iran. For years, critics of negotiations with Iran have said, well, MAD doesn't work when it comes to a regime like Iran. So what view do you take? Can this work for Israel that, should Israel have a declaratory nuclear policy? How does this play out in your mind?
I mean, I think it can work, but it's edgy. The Islamic Republic, the regime, has had many opportunities to show that they sort of had a nihilist bent in the direction of what we sort of think of Al-Qaeda has. And each and every time that hasn't happened. And you can look at Israeli actions in Syria. I mean, the Israelis have been pounding the Iranians in Syria. The Revolutionary Guard Corps was originally intending to bring in medium range missiles to establish very large bases. And the Israelis let loose their air power. And they started destroying a lot of machinery, killing Revolutionary Guards, senior commanders. And the Iranians changed their tactics completely. But most importantly, the Iranians didn't escalate. So they're scared of Israeli escalation. Now, if you're scared of Israeli...
They didn't escalate, but they didn't desist from building up their forces in Syria either.
Well, they've continued, but they changed the tactics and the way they do it. So they're not establishing easy targets for the Israelis to hit. They're being more secretive about it. I expect them to continue, but they're going to have trouble. They'll have a lot less trouble if the Americans withdraw from Syria, because we'll open up that highway that the Americans effectively block. So there are a lot of factors that come to play there, but I think the most important one is the Israelis have shown repeatedly you can intimidate the Islamic Republic. They are susceptible to military power. So now, is it possible to imagine a scenario where, let's say Khamenei dies and you get even a more hardcore individual, though he's pretty bloody hard, taking over.
It's Raisi who is now seen as the heir apparent. Right?
Yeah, Raisi is he's certainly worse. I mean, he's Khamenei without the brain power. So it's conceivable.
Is that better or worse?
Well, I think for the Israelis, it's worse. For the long-term health of the Islamic Republic, it's better in the sense that Raisi doesn't have the skill set that Khamenei has. And I think Khamenei quite correctly can be viewed as the most accomplished dictator in the Middle East since World War II. Raisi would be prone to making a lot more mistakes. Basically, all the man does is he's been running dungeons and a foundation to dispense largesse. So his skill set and his knowledge is really quite limited. I think he got most of his knowledge from Islamist literature, from reading Cliff Notes. But certainly when it comes to Israel, having Raisi as the supreme leader would be worrisome.
One sort of easy to anticipate consequence of a nuclear capable or a nuclear Iran is that Saudi Arabia won't wait long to reach for a nuclear capability, probably one they sometimes hint they have more or less stashed away in Pakistan. The Turks, who certainly have the capability, the industrial and knowledge base, would move quickly. Quite possibly even the Egyptians, although there the base is a little more limited. So you're suddenly looking at a Middle East in, let's say, 10 years, where you have not two antagonists with nuclear weapons and other countries caught in between, but the constellation of three, four, even five nuclear states, each of them at daggers drawn with one another. Tell me how that doesn't end in disaster.
Well, I mean, it's not a good scenario. I mean, I think the Turks will definitely go for it. I mean, with a few exceptions here and there, they have been, sort of the dominant force in the Middle East for 500 years. So if they choose to be, Kemalism, Ataturk sort of removed them temporarily from the Middle East, but they're beginning to move back in that direction. They're not going to allow the Iranians to have the upper hand here, and they certainly have the wherewithal to do this and do it much more rapidly than the Iranians have. The Saudis are more complicated. I don't think the PACs are going to give them a nuke. I don't think they'll come to the rescue, but you know, they're trying to buy nuclear energy, quote unquote, from the Chinese. It will take the Saudis a lot longer. The Saudi way is certainly to buy it, not build it. They don't have the skill set. They don't have the educational resources to do this quickly if they can't buy it. So I wouldn't expect an immediate nightmare. The Saudis might try to say the Pakistani jet has already landed in Riyadh and we are now a nuclear power, but I suspect that that won't be true. I mean, that what's disconcerting about the Saudis is their unwillingness to use the power that they have. Perhaps MBS, the crown prince, is scared to do so because he realizes his rule in the state is fragile. But I mean, and
when you say the power that they have,
their air power. I mean, for example, when the Iranians decided to take out through drones and cruise missiles about half of their oil production, 2019, that the they did nothing in response. Yet their air power, add on the Emirati air power, dwarfs anything the Iranians have. Yet they chose not to respond at all.
Not to respond because their air force, however well equipped in theory, is incompetent in practice, or because they feared escalation?
I think they fear escalation. I think they believe that in a tug of war with the Iranians, they lose. And I think that's the correct assessment. They probably do lose. So they have not gone there. I mean, you don't really have what I would call a big national backbone in either of those two states. So I think their response, and you could see it, I mean, the Emiratis were open about it. MBS was quiet. They sent emissaries to Tehran not long after that. And I think that is what you would expect for them to do, is to essentially try to negotiate their way out of it and say, listen, we're not going to be a threat. As long as the Americans are there, in the southern Middle East, then the Iranians are effectively checked. If they leave, then I think what we consider now inconceivable could become quite conceivable. First and foremost, you could imagine the Iranians going for Bahrain. You have a large captive Shiite population there, which is being radicalized by brutal behavior by the ruling family. So you could see the Iranians trying to stir up a lot of trouble much more aggressively. If the U.S. Navy and Air Force were not in the Persian Gulf.
And Israel would have to become a far more militarized state to be able to exercise or to fill in any of the gaps left by an American departure. So let me ask you, the Israelis have emphasized again and again that whatever is signed or agreed in Vienna doesn't bind Jerusalem. But does it? Is that true? I mean, in actual practice?
I think it certainly ties a few knots. I think amongst the many reasons why the Israelis haven't done this is concern about the American reaction, concern that it will permanently shear off the Democratic Party, that they will alienate, a lot of Americans, maybe some on the right too. And they don't want to, I mean, many Israelis still see themselves sort of being naturally part of European orbit, particularly on the left, the Israeli left, even though there's not much left of it. But they know that this would obviously pose considerable problems on the European side. I think the only reason they would take that risk is if they really felt in their guts an immediate existential threat. And the problem is the immediacy.
I mean, it's a case of boiling the frog here. I mean, the or the lobster, whatever, I can't remember which one it is. The same principle. Can the United States maintain a position in the Middle East with political support if you have what you're forecasting here is a pretty grim outlook, in that Iran is going to not only get this deal for all it means for its nuclear program, it's going to get billions of dollars. And if history is any guide, those billions will be spent on Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah, you know, the three H's, to essentially continue their march towards the establishment of a de facto Shiite crescent, as it's called, in the Middle East. That doesn't seem to me like something the United States is particularly keen to stop. So it forecasts an eventual American exit from the Middle East. Do you agree with that assessment? And then what does that mean?
Well, I mean, I think the United States has already given up on the Northern Middle East, with the exception of that critical strategically located outpost in Syria. I mean, the American presence in Iraq is still important, though it's highly limited. And I would argue that Iraq really is the big game, because that's where Iran could lose the most. I don't foresee, for example, the Syrian civil war starting up again. When that was active, then the Iranians were scared they could lose everything if they lost Syria, because it would jeopardize their position in Lebanon. They would have lost an open combat, and it would have been, I think, disastrous for the Revolutionary Guard Corps. But for the time being, it looks like they've got that one under control. So then you get back to Iraq, which is effectively a Shiite state. But a lot of those Shia do not like the Iranians. So you have this tension that exists, which is a long tension between what you call, you know, Arab and Ajam. Between Iranians and Arabs, and they know that. So they can't take a heavy footprint in Iraq. They have to do these things through the back door. They have to intimidate people, not out in the open, but more discreetly. So it's a more challenging game, but I don't see the Americans effectively trying to counter. I don't think we have the wherewithal to do that. Iraqi democracy, which is dead, by the way, works against us because it has a very profound nationalistic strain. So it limits Americans' actions there. So the Northern Middle East, I think it is for the most part lost. The Iranians have the sway there. The only ones who can possibly check them are the Turks. The Southern Middle East is different. I mean, as long as the American Navy and Air Force stay there, and it doesn't cost much for us to keep them there, then their mischief is limited. Obviously, we're not going to engage in greater aggressive behavior and try to, for example, stop their arming of the Houthis. That would be a very expensive endeavor to try to do that. The Houthis are more or less a win-win for the Iranians. It costs very little for them to maintain support for the Houthis, and it truly annoys, and perhaps in the long midterm, actually seriously weakens the Saudis. So it's a good game for them. We're not going to get into that, but we can stop worst case scenarios.
So go ahead.
And if we were, which we're not, going to maintain a sanctions wall, then you could at least deprive them of the hard currency and make it more likely that down the road, sooner, not later, that internal tumult comes back. I mean, the regime has feared for over 30 years now that you could have some unexpected spark inside of Iran that the security services simply cannot handle.
So if you were in the security cabinet in Israel, what would you advise?
Well, I mean, I would advise them to go for the strike. But you obviously have to have a consensus, and you have to be aware that they may not be able to do that. Obviously, you don't want to go for the strike if you don't think you have a chance of success. There's nothing worse than engaging in military action and losing completely. So you don't want to engage in something if you think, no, I just can't do that, in which case you'd have to default you're going to have to default to MAD. But if you think you could pull it off, then I would go for it. I think it's worth the risk. It's worth the roll of the dice to try it, because otherwise, I think you can say for with some confidence that they've got the nuke, and you're going to have to live with MAD. And there is that element. You know, it's for the United States, Iran isn't an existential threat, but for Israel, the potential is there. It is always going to be there. So I think it is worth rolling the dice to see if you can change the outcome.
Well, a final question before we turn to the audience questions. A year ago or so, Iran and China inked a strategic agreement. This creates a kind of a trilateral axis between Russia, China, and Iran with Beijing as the hub. How should that change our thinking, if at all?
Well, I mean, there are, you know, three pretty aggressive revisionist powers in play, the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians. So it is natural the three would align up. I think for the Iranian side, what that's going to bring them is advanced weaponry, conventional weaponry. They have been starved of conventional weaponry for a variety of reasons, sanctions being a big one.
They're still flying, if they can fly, jets from the year of the Shah.
Absolutely. I mean, I have to give them compliments. They've been pretty industrious in smuggling in parts and trying to keep what they have flying. So I would expect the Iranians to start investing a lot more money in conventional weaponry, a lot more. And they need the Russians, and Chinese wouldn't be bad either, because Chinese technology in certain areas is superior to the Russians. So that for them is the biggest plus. And also with the Chinese, it gives them an outlet against sanctions. That is an important factor. The Iranians talk about it. The Chinese option, the Iranians would prefer to buy European. They really do love European products. They like German products in particular. Their trade, heavy industry, they much prefer to go towards Europe than the East, but they will go to the East. And they look as the Chinese option as a serious option to limit, curtail the damage that Western powers, in particular the United States, can do to them.
So it sounds to me, just before I turn to the audience, it sounds to me that what you are saying is we may not be able to stop Iran from becoming at least a nuclear capable state. It may already be a nuclear capable state. Our choice really with this agreement is whether we want it to be an impoverished nuclear capable state or a much richer one. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the choice. And with choice number two, again, that you up the possibility of internal convulsion, which ultimately is the objective. It's like, you know, I was once in Paris, and they have a very good nuclear team, always have had one, a very good Iran team. And you know, I just said to them,
yes, the analysis is great, but the conclusion sometimes leaves.
Yes, yeah, that's always a French problem. But they punch above their weight. Yeah. And they're all before me, and I said, all right, everybody honest, how many of you here are in favor of regime change? You know, everyone raised their hand. All right, everybody wants regime change. It's just that no one wants to go through the effort, the process that might accelerate it. So if regime change is the ultimate answer to the Islamic Republic, unfortunately, it doesn't appear that it's going to be coming anytime soon.
I don't know if they punch above their weight. They think above their punch might be more.
All right. If you want to be, if you want to be mean, you know, as I'm somewhat a Francophile.
So let me turn to our audience. And seriously, please ask away. The purpose of these conversations is for the benefit of those tuning in. So Jay Myish asks, What is the best argument you can make in favor of doing the deal with Iran with Russian cooperation?
Well, I mean, if you want the deal to happen, it's all been set up and premised on the Russians taking the highly enriched uranium. So you would have to find, I guess you would have to have the Chinese take it. They'd have to agree to it. So I suspect that if the Russian part of this were taken out,
but there, you know, there are reactors in Ukraine that could surely use more enriched uranium.
Yes, that I suspect the entire deal would unravel. So I don't think they'll want to go there. I don't think the Europeans will want to go there. I would expect, I mean, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has complicated this and made things uglier. But I would expect the Europeans, all of them, particularly the Brits, the French, and the Germans, to support this deal.
That's the best argument you can make in favor of the deal?
Yeah, I would make no argument in favor of the deal, but yes, I mean, if you believe that the deal gives us another 2 or 3 or 4 year surcease to our nuclear anxiety, if you don't mind being extorted, then I think you're going to have to keep the Russians in it. If you cut them out, I suspect the whole thing will unravel.
Ephraim Perlmutter asks, what is the estimated last date that an effective military strike could be made against the Iranian nuclear project? I don't think he's actually asking for a date per se, but a threshold, right?
Well, that's a good question. My old abode, Langley, is telling the White House that the Iranians can reconstitute a nuclear weapons program 2 to 3 months after an American military strike. Now, I don't have confidence in that guess, as I don't have confidence in a lot of things that the agency says about Iran. But certainly, the White House, I think, pays attention to such estimates. So far as the very, very last moment, you know, we're very close to that. It really all depends. I mean, they have the knowledge necessary. They have the knowledge necessary to build a nuclear trigger. If that guess is right, the Israeli guess, and they haven't designed the nuclear trigger, the only reason they haven't done that is not because of any technical deficiency. It's because to do that, you need absolute security. There's no way you can camouflage the construction of a nuclear trigger as part of a civilian program. And the Iranians have had trouble. They have had leaks in the system. They have had walk-ins. We've been the beneficiary of walk-ins. They know that. So they would want to keep that at the very end of this process. So the answer is, whatever that distance is from them designing the nuclear trigger, it's not enrichment anymore. They've figured that out. If you were targeting the centrifuges, it would have to be that, you know, it'd have to be whatever that moment is when they're, you know, spinning them up. You know, the longer we wait on this, and we've been waiting on this, debating this for, you know, actually not really debating it for years and years and years, the more you push this off, the harder a military operation becomes, the more complex it becomes, the easier it is for the Iranians to recover. And I think it has to be said that, you know, you might have one military strike and it might convulse the entire Iranian political system. It might convulse the nuclear program, but maybe not. You might have to strike again. So it's not an easy thing to approach with enthusiasm.
Gary Rosenstein asks, we now see a world financial industry closing off Russia. We also see deplatforming of Russia's individuals around the world. What is the likelihood that Israel may be deterred from attacking Iran's nuclear sites for fear of being viewed as an aggressor state and being cut off in the same way that Russia is now being cut off?
I mean, I think that's unlikely. I don't think you would have you certainly wouldn't have a consensus in the United States to do that. And I don't think you'd have a consensus in the European Union. So if you don't have a consensus in the West, nothing's happening.
Eric Cantor asks, with a Chinese-built port in Haifa, does Beijing have a potentially sobering effect on Iran Ari Israel?
No, I don't think that's.
And why not?
I don't think the Iranian Chinese nexus has developed to the point that, and I'm not sure the Iranians will allow it to develop to that point where they could conceivably check Iranian actions. The Iranians are very sensitive to the foreign intrusion. There are big debates about even allowing, you know, Russian fighter bombers to refuel on the way to Syria. They did, they continued to do it, but I mean, it's a prickly issue. So I don't think the Chinese are gonna get that type of leverage over the Iranians.
One point that I think is notable, this isn't being asked here, but I'm just reminded of it, is Israel has conspicuously been in the camp of non-denunciation when it comes to the war in Ukraine because of various Israeli equities vis-a-vis Russian Jewry and vis-a-vis Russian control of Syrian airspace. And Natan Sharansky, among others, has, you know, made the point that this is the result of a kind of American dereliction of duty that has forced Israel to adopt much more of a freelancing position than it might have, say, 20 years ago, where, you know, the thing to do was just stand behind the United States at moments like this when it's corralling international support. So are we seeing here in Ukraine and perhaps with respect to China as well, Israel beginning to feel its way, even if tentatively, towards a more independent foreign policy stand where automatic obedience to the wishes of the United States is just no longer quite taken for granted? And if that's true, what does that mean? Or what do you think that says about Israel's state? Because on the one hand, it suggests a kind of maturity, right, that it can do this. On the other hand, it suggests that it's being cast off.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's undoubtedly true. The Israelis are trying to find a path, a more wiggle room from the United States. I think many Israelis are angst-ridden over it. It's going to demand much more of them. I mean, listen, the Abraham Accords would never have happened if it hadn't been for American weakness. They're not a product of American hegemony. They're a product of the absence of it. So, in that sense,
Obama brought the Arabs and Israelis together in united opposition to him.
Yes. So, the there is an upside, you might say, to the weakening of American power in the Middle East. But the downside of it for the Israelis is they have to take on a lot of responsibilities, or they at least have to stare at the ugly choices before them. And I suspect those choices will become more difficult. They are fortunate in a sense that the, you know, the Arab world is more or less imploded. So what had been near enemies are no more. I mean, probably the greatest threat that they fear from Egypt is that it completely implode. So, you know, that they have a lot less to worry about, and that's a good thing, but they obviously do have to worry about Iran and countering it, because its ideological core is still vivid. It's not dead yet. They haven't moved anywhere close to Thermidor. In fact, they seem to be going in the opposite direction. So, and Israel is a target, and that's going to remain.
Thermidor is not a culinary reference just here. It's simply a revolutionary or a reactionary reference.
Does that mean you have Thermidor in the kitchen?
I do, yes. David Weiss asks, given all these circumstances, what are the probabilities, advantages of an alliance or at least significant cooperation between Turkey and Israel to counterbalance Iranian power? Is there enough mutual interest there?
Well, I think there would certainly be interest on Israel's part. Whether there would be sufficient interest on Ankara's part, that's more problematic. I think part of this new Turkey has a much more profound Islamic component. Dealing with Israel is trickier. It's not the Kamalists anymore. It's not impossible, but it is going to be difficult. And certainly with Erdogan, who sees himself sort of as a Sunni overlord, I don't think the Israelis can have any confidence in that, arrangement. Though it is possible transactionally, for I think the Israelis and the Turks maybe to combine and against certain Iranian actions.
Wolf Grossman asks, how can MAD, mutually assured destruction, work when Iran has declared it is willing and able to absorb very heavy losses in a nuclear exchange with Israel, stating further that their view is that Israel does not have the ability to absorb due to its diminutive geographic size?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the gentleman who said that was Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, the former major domo of the political clergy, who was gutted, by the way, by the Supreme Leader. I don't think it's true. I don't think they are willing. And I think their past actions have shown them repeatedly that they don't have this sort of nihilist, millennial Islamic desire. So I think the Israelis have clearly shown they can check them in Syria, that the Iranians aren't willing to escalate. And the Iranians always think first about their home front. So they know how precarious their hold on the country could be, and they don't want to take, I think, severe shocks. So I would be surprised if they want to get into a nuclear slugging match with the Israelis, so long as the Israelis maintain nuclear forces at sea, then I think...
You're referring to the submarines.
Yes, then I think the Iranians know that they're going to get obliterated. And I think they know the Israelis would obliterate them. I don't think the Israelis have to worry a lot about Armageddon, but at the same time, it is an existential concern of the First Order, which is why I would not want to roll the dice, and I would roll the dice on a preventive strike if the Israelis have the capacity, because I do think it's worth the risk. But I don't think the Iranians are going to easily, they're not going to go into a fist fight with the Israeli, a nuclear fist fight with the Israelis.
Lauren Blatt wants to know, what is the best option for the U.S. at this point?
What, the best or the politically possible?
Why don't we say best first and then see what's political?
Yeah, I mean, best, I think, would have been, I would have been in favor of preventive strikes a long time ago. I think if you're going to be a hegemonic power, you should not allow a virulently anti-American theocracy that's killed hundreds of Americans over the years to have a nuclear weapon. Stop, full stop, take it out. But that is not politically an option. So I think if you then have...
What is the best politically available option then?
I think politically available option, it depends on a few variables here. So we're not quite clear, but the best option would be for the United States to go into a long-term containment strategy against the Islamic Republic so that we realize, at least amongst ourselves on a political level, that regime change is the only viable answer, and develop a containment strategy, which is a regime change strategy. Containment is about regime change. And bring as much pressure, economic pressure, regional pressure as we can. Now, it's going to be limited. Now, I think we've reached a high water mark on sanctions. We're never going to have that type of sanctions pressure again. So a lot of these things are very, very difficult.
You don't think so even under a future Tom Cotton administration?
I think they'll come back, but I don't think you're ever going to get the squeeze hold that we had under Trump. I would be surprised.
But so in this cheerful conversation we're having, Ro, my standard joke is that at every Jewish event you have to be as depressing as humanly possible, or otherwise people want their money back. But any hope? Someone wants to ask. What is, you were hinting at this with a containment strategy, but where is a ray of light in this analysis?
Well, I mean, the ray of light is the vast majority of the Iranian people hate their regime. And it's evident. I mean, you have to be blind, deaf, and dumb not to see it now. So you as long as that's the case, I mean, the revolution has failed to regenerate itself in the way it envisioned, the way it dreamed. Now that makes the ruling elite actually nastier, all right? But the long-term prognosis, maybe the midterm prognosis is, on this is pretty good. If you were to have the collapse of the Islamic Republic, it would, like the revolution in 79, send shockwaves throughout the entire region. And they'd be mostly good shockwaves. But that is not something that seems at all likely short-term. It's possible. I mean, I always have to say that the Iranian security services, they plan, that's the bad news, they plan on the unexpected spark, that something could happen that could set off a wildfire and they simply cannot control. So we always have to know that is a possibility. You can't really build policy based on that possibility, but it should inform all of our actions. And certainly it should inform us when we look midterm and long-term and say, all right, if this is a villainous regime, let us try to bring and keep as much pressure on it as possible. The problem is the Biden administration is really different. It is the first administration since 1979 that is not searching for moderates in the Islamic Republic. It's really quite striking. They're doing a deal with the worst people in the regime, what we used to, the hardcore, and that's all they want. They're not doing it as Obama did it, with the expectation that capitalism would, you know, cool the religious, nasty religious impulses, and we'd all, you know, eventually have some type of kumbaya experience. I don't think the Biden administration, I don't think Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan have any illusions now about the nature of the Islamic Republic. They have no long-term hope that the trade will change the nature of the Islamic Republic. I think they're just after a very short-term solution so they can kick the can down the road, get it off the plate, and then turn to something they care about, which is Russia and China.
Well, thank you so much for this hour. I'm more despondent, but I think much better informed. And I hope that's true of everyone who listened in. The issue is called Aspiration, Sapir. We started this a year ago with the Maimonides Fund to spark conversations of the kind that we're having here in the search for pragmatic answers and solutions to create thriving Jewish life, and not just intellectual life, but the rest of living as well. And I hope this was worth the time of the people who listened in. It's certainly worth mine. I really want to thank you, Raul, for participating in this. We will have subsequent conversations. Sapir, initially we envisioned 4 issues. We're now extending that, and our next issue is going to be about Zionism. So please continue to participate. I really want to thank the people who tuned in, and let's meet again, and welcome to my study. Have a lovely rest of your day.
My pleasure. Thank you.